The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is The Heretics Hour, and it's coming to you live from The White Network for the next 2 hours. With me tonight is Hadding Scott.
Hello.
Yes. Hi, Hadding. And Hadding is here at my request because the scheduled guest, Arthur Topham of Radical Press, had to cancel on this show, which I learned this morning, because it was really at the insistence of his lawyer, who didn't know about it. And when he learned about it, he said, absolutely not. You cannot go on a radio show at this time. And, you know, Arthur has been in under terrible harassment by the what's often called the Canadian Thought Police and so on. And they, you know, raided his home, took all his computers and files and so on. And he was in jail for a while. And now he's kind of back going again. But he's still got things that he has to take care of. And he's still not free and clear, I guess. And his lawyer said, and his lawyer happens to be Doug Christie. Very good lawyer, so he's doing what he says. So we don't have Arthur, but we've got a very good show for you tonight, I think, because of developments that have taken place, and we're really up to the last minute here with our program tonight. And you know, tonight is also the final presidential debate, and when Arthur said he couldn't be on. Well, I guess it was not this morning. It was yesterday morning. He didn't give me that short notice. It was yesterday morning, Sunday morning, when he told me. And so, but I thought, well, I'll just take off. I'll, you know, watch the debate. I've gotten interested somehow in this election, finally. I'm not that interested, but I am, but at the same time I am. So I thought, well, I'll watch that. But, then the more time went by and I relaxed and I thought, oh, I just can't give up doing my show when I have an opportunity to come on and talk about things for a couple hours. Why would I, you know, not do it? So we've worked all this out and here we are. So, and here you are, and we probably won't have as many listeners because of the debate, but that's okay. What, Hattie?
Just said yes, here I am.
Yes, right. Now,
Nielsen's don't show too much damage to the ratings on the debate because of.
Yeah, I hope we don't. I hope we don't damage the people watching. Even Tan Stoffel is watching the debate tonight. He's invited neighbors. Some of his neighbors are coming over to watch it at his house. So he's not even on. It can't be on to help us. And the only reason we might need some help is that we're introducing our telephone number for our White Network programs now, which is, I'm going to give you the number, but I don't want you to call it. Okay. Our number is 1-877-443-4911. But as you can see, it's not toll free. And, if you call, you're calling on your own, dime, but we don't want anyone to call in during the first hour because I'm not sure yet. Tan was testing it out and so on, but he says everything works real well, but there's a possibility that in the hanging up of callers, I could go off, you know, I could crash or something. So we're being very careful about that. And we are expecting a call in the second hour, shortly after it gets going from Fred, our friend, Frederick Tobin. He's traveling. He said he will be traveling at this time. Of course, it's tomorrow where he is in Australia. But he's also been been taken to the cleaners by the Jews in Australia, and they are crowing happy that he has been declared bankrupt, that the court has declared him bankrupt, and he won't be able to use his passport. They've taken his passport. But anyway, Fred has a counter thing going where he's accusing these Jews of defamation, countersuit, thank you. accusing them of defamation. And so he's still involved, too, and he says he can't say too much. But he's going to try to call in and talk for just a little bit. But I'll tell you about his case, too, in the second hour. But we're going to start out tonight starting out with the BBC documentary that took place today based on Jimmy Savile, which I talked about on Saturday quite a bit. But now there's just, you know, it's just interesting what new developments, and I'm interested in this. So we're going to go through that, and then we're going to talk about the announcement on Countercurrents of James O'Meara's book that's been promised for some time called The Homo and the Negro. So, and we have quite a bit on that. So that might take up the first half of the show. Well, we have more listeners now, so some people have decided they'd rather listen to us than the debate. Hanning, let's see. I'm going to start out by just saying that this BBC ran a very special attempt to cover the, you know, take care of the damage. What's that called? Damage control.
Damage control.
Yeah, on their panorama, they have this their top news show that's not really hard news, but, you know, investigative reporting, investigative stuff. They have one every day, and so they do series of this and that. So they just threw this thing together on their failure last December to run a program about the rumors and so on and the accusations against this Jimmy Savile. I found out his name is pronounced Savile. I was pronouncing it Savile, so now it's going to be Jimmy Savile. So the background of the story is that last December, while he was still alive, and I hope that those of you who are listening know who he is by now. I talked about him quite a bit on Saturday, and he's in the news. There's been big stories about him. He is what is being, he's being called a pedophile who was loose, and he was a big star at BBC since the 1970s. That's over 40 years. And all that time, he was abusing girls and boys. And he had plenty of opportunity because he set himself up also as a big philanthropist who was allowed to go into hospitals. In fact, he was like honorary this and honorary that. And everybody let him do whatever he wanted. And he was in there, you know, doing things. And then somehow he got away with it because people wouldn't tell on him, or if they did, nobody cared. And I think this is what we're going to find out, that there's the people who are saying, oh, we're so shocked, they knew, but they didn't do anything about it, and they thought they could keep it under the rug because he was a big star at BBC, and he was, his programs were basically children's programs. He was all connected with children. And it's very interesting from the overall perspective of what I've been talking about in so many of my programs recently. So in this documentary that the BBC came up with today, it would be for them last night, happened today afternoon or something like that, for us here in the United States, how was I going to present this? Okay, what they came up with to explain what happened. The main problem that they're having is that last December, when Savile was alive still, and they had a program then called Newsnight, and Newsnight is no longer exists, and instead they have this Panorama, which they may have had then too. I don't know. But Newsnight was one of their best investigative programs, and they were going to do a program on all these rumors about Savile and the things that some women were saying, and then at the last minute they canceled it, And at the same time they ran, this was in December of 2011, at the same time they ran several, or maybe two only or whatever, tribute programs to this man. And then he died, he was 84, and he died within the last 2 months, I think. I mean, he died very recently. And then this stuff started coming out almost immediately. So now what I've got here is that the program today, before the program aired, this former editor of Newsnight, Peter Rippon, has stood aside. This is a big thing. The BBC announced that he has stood aside overnight, you know, just last night for us. This was announced that he's stepping down from whatever position he has. He's an editor at BBC for the time being. And therefore, he's no longer, you know, doing anything at BBC for now. And then also the director general of BBC, who is the man named Entwistle, he's been with BBC for a long time, but he's worked himself up now. He's the head guy. He's the head guy now, but he wasn't last December. He was something called vision director or something, but he is facing increasing pressure, and it comes out in this documentary. Now, the Daily Telegraph in Britain has said that it's alleging that a key element in the Panorama show was removed upon the instruction of BBC lawyers. And they're talking about this Peter Rippon. They said that he's a key element, and they removed him so that he wouldn't be a part of what's even though he's being talked about. He was talked about in the documentary. I'm not clear how all that works, but supposedly that's the lawyers decided that. And they announced that he opted. Before the BBC announced the editor of the Newsnight program, Peter Rippon, was stepping aside with immediate effect. Well, that's just another way of saying what I already said. So on another on today's program, Rippon was said to have appeared to play down the evidence of the victims as coming from just the women. There's a kind of a background noise that's coming probably from you.
I shouldn't be hearing anything from you because I have my microphone covered.
Well, it just stopped. I don't know. There's a little bit of it. Maybe the listeners don't hear it. Okay, I'll continue because I'm getting into it now, finally. He appeared to play down the evidence of the victims as coming from just the women. This is something that was brought up about him in this Panorama program. Back then, in December, they've revealed an email that he sent to staff. He said, having pondered this overnight, I think the key is whether we can establish the CPS. I don't know what the CPS is. Did drop the case for the reasons the women say. That makes it a better story. Our sources so far are just the women and a secondhand briefing. Well, he's being criticized already for having said that the sources are just the women, and so that's not very strong, and therefore, you know, they could drop the whole thing. They don't have to pay attention to it. That's just one of the latest things I found, so I thought I'd throw that in there. Well, this BBC's director now, George Entwistle, was a major player in the decision to broadcast a tribute to Saville. That was back in December. So what happened, you know, is that they had these tributes scheduled, and then they had this program on news, on their very popular and prestigious Newsnight program, showing that there was a lot of accusations about Saville sexually abusing women and young women and girls and stuff. And so
teenage
they
girls.
Had this, yeah, teenage girls. They had this dilemma. And so the dilemma was that they canned the Newsnight investigation. And this was at Entwistle's was involved in this. It was basically his decision, but it was Rippon, Peter Rippon, the head guy of the Newsnight investigate program that is the one who is being directly blamed for it, because he's the one who did it, who made it. He made the decision, but of course he was doing what his what the people above him wanted him to do. So some of the stuff that happened was, okay, so we've got these two male figures, two very big people at BBC. Then we have Newsnight producer Marion Jones and a Newsnight reporter, Liz McKeon, who were on the documentary program, the new one that aired a few hours ago, finished. They both claim that they had interviewed at least four alleged victims of Saville for this program back in December, and they had confirmed that the Surrey police had investigated sex abuse complaints against Jimmy Saville in 2007. At that time, he was the star of Jim'll Fix It. He had quite a few programs. He had a top 10 or a top of the pops or something music program. He had this Jim'll Fix It. He was supposed to be a guy who fixed everybody's problems up. You know, he's a very colorful person. I hope you've seen the pictures of him. He had this white hair, which he kind of made look blonde at times, and long, and he wore those little red glasses. But, you know, I've seen pictures of him where he's not all done up like that, and he wasn't a bad-looking guy when he was younger. And he looked like he had a pretty good body. There's some pictures of him without hardly any clothes on. No, so, I mean, you know, I think it's going to come out that he was also homosexual because he, or maybe he's bisexual or whatever, because it's going to come out that he abused both boys and girls all these years. And that, the big thing is that it went over such a long period of time.
Boys too?
Boys too. That hasn't come out yet, but I think the police have got all that stuff. That's gonna come out. Now, so they say that, when the bosses of the, I don't know if I want to say this. So they were told that because of insufficient evidence, they were told to end the investigation. And at that time, the show was withdrawn in December. But that was supposedly not true, that there were some things that Rippon said that weren't true, and I'll get to that in a minute here. So Mr. Jones was this Newsnight producer, Marion Jones, and he produced on this documentary program, this new one, he produced emails that he had sent to Mr. Rippon 5 days after the show was withdrawn to warn him about what would happen if the investigation was dropped, or when they said, well, let's drop this investigation, let's drop this program. And Mr. Jones said that, I was sure the story would come out one way or another, and that if it did, the BBC would be accused of a cover-up. And he told Rippon that. And he said, in fact, I wrote an email to Peter saying the story is strong enough, that's a quote, and the danger of not running it is substantial damage to BBC reputation. 2 days later, Mr. Rippon decided to kill the investigation. This is what was on the program today. And they heard new evidence in this program of suspicions within the BBC about Saville's activities as far back as the early 70s. And also a reporter nationwide, I guess that might be another BBC show, Bob Langley, was sent to cover one of Saville's many charity runs for the earlier program I think that would have been in December, those tributes. And on two occasions, he spotted young girls coming out of Saville's caravan. Well, that's nothing, you know, outstanding now, because we know all that. Another last-minute development is that five leading women's rights organizations have demanded the BBC investigate institutional sexism in the wake of these allegations about Saville, that he abused underage girls during his time at the corporation. Well, you know, I do think that in spite of Hadding, in spite of all the talk all the time about feminism and how women are running everything, or that men aren't in charge, women are in charge or something, there is institutional sexism still, wherever you go. And in Britain, it's very strong.
From it.
No, you're not benefiting, but it's not whether who's benefiting from it. It's just whether what exists and what doesn't, if we're going to talk about this. So we know that at the BBC, and I'm trying to point out that it is, you know, it's all men. You know, men are in charge there. Men are in control. Men are in control of the British government. There are women, you know, here and there, and some of them have some power, and they're not very, very nice either. There's some women in this BBC that have gone along with, was it in the Labour government? Both gone along with some things. So they all turn away and don't talk about things that they're not supposed to talk about. If they're going to lose out, if just like you say you don't benefit. Everybody, you know, if they're going to lose out, if they're going to lose their job, or if they're going to lose their position, they're not going to say anything. And this went on kind of blatantly for 40 years in this institution. So I'm interested in this because I really hope that this does some serious damage to the BBC and to the mainstream media and to the British establishment. But I think that probably concerning how these things go, it'll be a big story for a while. And in the end, it won't really change anything. Unfortunately, but people should know about it. All you can do is try to get people to know about it.
Well, you know, I think Saville had friends, and they decided that they didn't want to embarrass their friend, and he had those connections, and that worked in his favor, and that happens in the United States as well. I know of from a friend of a friend who, you know, I have a friend who talked to a policeman, that there was a very famous radio commentator that was arrested in my town for trying to pick up boys, and it was all hushed up.
Well, it is, and it's not just Saville's friends. It's the BBC. It's the organizations that are protecting themselves, and they protect this kind of thing. Police departments protect things. Just like you say, this guy was picked up, but it was all hushed up. Who hushed it up?
Yeah.
All right.
I don't know how that works, but I tend to think that this kind of thing, well, for one thing, there used to be a lot more of that, I believe, before the 1970s. You know, presidents used to be able to get away with a lot of the stuff that Nixon did, but for some reason, when Nixon was in there, they kind of changed the standards, and you couldn't get away with that stuff anymore.
Well, Nixon wasn't getting away with sex stuff. You could get away with all kinds of sex stuff.
Johnson was doing some crazy stuff, but they could get away with breaking the law in small ways. There got to be a lot more challenging of authority by the media. In the 70s, they became a lot more iconoclastic, aggressively iconoclastic, whereas they hadn't been like that before the 70s. And I think in the UK, they probably didn't go through that shift the way we did. So they probably are much more in the habit of covering things up.
Well, you know, if we get into the big change, the sexual revolution in the 1960s, then it would be that there was more liberalism in the attitude toward people doing this. You didn't have to cover it up so much. So like you did earlier, where all the presidents, say, just to use presidents, had to appear to be, you know, perfect paragons of virtue and so on. But with the sexual revolution of the 60s and all the other revolutions that it brought in its wake, then things, I don't know, people started using drugs, you know, presidents use drugs. Kennedy used drugs. And, you know, when you think about it, I mean, that would have been, that's a terrible thing for a president who's supposed to be on call all the time, you know, to pick up the red phone and talk to the big main enemy of the day and whatever. We had that going on back then with the Soviet Union and Khrushchev and so on, and they had to be able to, you know, in the middle of the night, whatever. Well, he's out there with women, and you know, I liked Kennedy so much. I'm not a Kennedy basher. I'm a Kennedy, Jack Kennedy fan. But the facts are the facts. You know, he was with girlfriends, doing drugs. He was kind of testing them. He hadn't been a big drug taker, I guess. But now today, I mean, Barack Obama uses drugs, and Barack Obama is off doing all kinds of things. I'm sure of it. And even if he weren't doing that, they say he's off playing golf, and he plays golf with this foursome, with this three other guys. They have a foursome. I read that he played, you know, this could be wrong, but, he played, the logs show that he was out playing golf. I don't know how many, so many hundred days, in a certain period of time, that in a couple of years or a year or something, more times than he had meetings, and it was always with the same three guys. And one of them is known to be a homosexual, and the others might be, and he is. So they weren't always playing golf, I guess. I don't know. You know, this kind of stuff, when you can talk like this about your president or your head of state, it's something very wrong in your society going on. But anyway, I got off the track a little bit there. But here,
you know, when I said that I hadn't benefited from any pro male bias, that was ironic understatement. I've definitely suffered from anti male bias.
Well, yeah, I know you think you have.
I think I have. I'm not sure what that has to do with this Saville thing. He got protected because he's
famous. The other way. Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, this stuff is going on, and so you can't say that everybody's experiencing what you're experiencing. Well, they're talking about this blog that Rippon wrote back when he was defending. At some point, he wrote this blog defending his decision in December, and he gave an explanation that now the BBC itself has come out and said that he said things that were inaccurate or incomplete. So I think this Rippon, who already they have already taken out of his position, you know, last night or something, he stepped aside. He's going to take a whole lot of the blame for this. And so is this Entwistle, who is going before the parliament tomorrow. He's going for a parliamentary special commission meeting, and I have something here about that in a second, as soon as I get to it, see if there's anything important here. In the blog, he claimed that all the women, this Rippon, claimed that all the women spoken to by the program had contacted the police, and that Newsnight had no new evidence against that would have helped the police. But the BBC is now admitting, saying that in some cases, some women had not spoken to the police, and that the police were not aware of all of the allegations at that time. And, of course, Prime Minister David Cameron has to get in on it, and he calls the developments disturbing. And he has said, because the BBC has effectively changed its story, what's disturbing? The biggest problem is that the BBC has effectively changed its story about why it dropped the program. So, you know, whenever you change your story, everywhere in politics and so on, that, you know, then it's like, well, you were either stupid before or you were lying or what, you know, it's not a good thing to change your story. And this is what they all say is the biggest problem here with the BBC. Cameron has also hinted that this Saville should lose his Medal of Honor. He's gotten all kinds of medals from the British He's a, you know, British hero of all kinds and so on.
That's a knight in the Catholic Church.
Oh, that was it. His sir should be, you know, his knighthood. Because he's Sir Jimmy Savile. That should be removed. And he says that there's ways that that can be done. So, you know, everybody wants to make themselves look good, even though they all, if they all knew or if they had learned about it back then, they wouldn't have given a darn. You know, they wouldn't have done a thing about it. This is it's the hypocrisy of it. Now, the last thing I have here, is that, I was trying to think of when this Savile story came out, you know, because it just sort of came out and there it was. But I don't know where it started, but I saw this that, it started on an ITV broadcast on October 4th. ITV is another, I guess, competitor of BBC TV, and they had broadcast a documentary on October 4th about this Jimmy Savile, and it was titled Exposure, The Other Side of Jimmy Savile. It was a big hit, and it drew 1.9 million viewers and a 22.6% audience share, which is, I guess, not usual for them. And during the time it was on, it's the best figures they ever had. It's ITV1 investigative documentary. They do a lot of these investigative documentaries. Even here they do it. They do a lot of those. I don't watch TV, but I know there's used to be a lot of them. Okay, now one more thing here before we move on, and that is that what's going to happen tomorrow in the Parliament, British Parliament, is that, as I already mentioned, this committee, this Culture, Media, and Sports Committee, chaired by John Whittingdale, is going to take evidence from Mr. Entwistle of BBC. He has to appear before them tomorrow, and they're gonna want to know, you know, why he did not seek more information about the Newsnight investigation. And this is what this Whittingdale has been quoted as saying: "If you were the director of Vision." Oh, that's what this guy was then. you were told at the time that you were commissioning programs paying tribute to Jimmy Savile that Newsnight might be about to reveal a bombshell, you know, another program on your network. You wouldn't just have a 10-second conversation, which is what happened. He had a real quick conversation with somebody and then walked away and never talked to him again about it. This guy, this MP, goes on to say, "You'd say, tell me more. I'm about to go public, putting out these programs, making out that Jimmy Savile was this saint." So Whittingdale also says that the most important question that was going to come up tomorrow was why the Newsnight segment was dropped. So this is what this guy is going to have to answer. So it goes on, and I'm waiting for the police investigation to start giving out some information that they have from all these people that are now coming forth that from this 40 years that this guy was going, and all the people that are going to say what happened to him and how many they're going to be and who they are and so on. It's going to be very interesting because he was not only was groping children all the time, even in hospital patients, when he had the chance. But he was having sex with these underage girls at various times, and there were people who even saw it. They didn't actually see that, but they saw enough to know what was going on. And they say he was very manipulative, very, very manipulative. He has all the marks of a kind of a psychopath who's just, everybody thought was such a great, you know, was this great character, TV character that everybody loved.
Yeah.
But people who were close to him now say they're afraid to say it before. Now everybody's talking. He was so manipulative, and he frightened people, and he made people believe they better not say anything about him. And he gave people gifts and promised them things and so on, and they all wanted to get something from him. So
yeah.
You know, they didn't speak out. Just
make you
amazing.
Famous.
Yeah, but you know, this is such a tremendous educational which is why I'm talking about it a lot. I think it's very important and interesting because it can explain, it can show us so much. It's like a demonstration of how this kind of thing works. So, all right, now we can go on to, unless you want to say anything more about that. I kind of did that part. Now we can go.
What incidents?
What?
How long ago did all this happen?
With Jimmy Savile?
Yeah.
Well, no, I said started in the early 70s.
That's a long time ago, but I mean, as far as the more recent incidents, what were
they?
Well,
as I said, up until the time he retired. And I don't know, he only died I don't know if he died a year ago, a little over a year ago. He was still alive last December. So it was less than a year ago. And you know, here's something interesting. They've already removed his, at the family's request, they say, the cemetery he was buried in, he had this big three-part monument at his grave. I saw a picture of it. It was very elaborate, a big, you know, picture of him and everything, and very large thing. And overnight, they removed it, just like with Rudolf Hess. You know, they showed this picture of nothing there but a few flowers laying there or something, and they had it all covered over. Well, they haven't removed his body, but now the family says, the family is fed, you know, is just, they stayed quiet all this time. Now that it's come out, they're saying he's shamed everybody. He shamed the nation. And, you know, we can't stand up for him. And they're going to, they think they're going to take his body out of there too eventually. But they took this big monument and they carted it off to the cemetery workyard or something. And they ground off all that was on it. And then they broke it up into pieces. And they're already done. They do that real quick. And then they're going to take it to some undisclosed landfill. So this, everybody is quick. I mean, this guy is going to be, and he said before to some friends in the last years of his life, and particularly in the last year, that after he died, everything was going to change. I mean, he was prepared for that. And he told one person that the only thing that's important is while you're alive. Because he knew that he was going to be trashed after he died, but he kept it. He had the ability to keep it going until after he died, until after he was 84. So it's just very, very instructive. I think everybody should read up about it, not just to get all the sleazy stuff, but just to see how this actually happened. And BBC is in trouble because they're saying they have to explain how this guy got away with this, and a whole lot of it was on the BBC premises all these years. How, you know, and they, of course, they can't explain it. They're going to fire a bunch of people.
So he was preying on emotionally disturbed girls in hospitals.
Yeah, part of it.
That's what I saw.
And he was also preying on girls who came to the set over his TV shows and so on. You know, you see all these pictures of him with all these kids around him.
Just from a devil's advocate, how rare do you think it is for male celebrities to take advantage of their celebrity, especially back in the 1970s?
No, it's not. I think of him as a Bob Hope type. I always think of Bob Hope as a real sleazeball, but he might not have gone after children, see, or young kids, but he certainly went after girls and women. And there's some others, a whole lot of these show business people. Yeah, it's like that. That's why I'm thinking about calling this program something about sleaze, because we're going to go into some more sleaze now, I think, and we better maybe do it so we can have time for it. And that is, and this might, you know, here we go again, but it's come up today. They announced on Countercurrents, the sale of James O'Meara's book is people can put in their orders now, and they had a It's not a blog, but it's they had a write-up about it and some comments by three people, Greg Johnson and Jack Donovan, another homosexual that's known to be, and Wolf Grimson, who is another homosexual. So these three homosexuals commented, you know, praised.
We don't know that about Greggy.
Well, I'm going to bring up I was going to bring up that Matt Parrott, you know, I want to know what he has to say after reading this page on Countercurrents today, which is just amazing for what's on there. And how's he going to respond to what he said back when, and I mentioned it on one of my programs, when he said there's no evidence that Greg Johnson is a homosexual. And then he's, you know, written more and more blogs on there. And now, you know, how does he respond to that, that Countercurrents is not a site that is promoting homosexuality more than anything else that it promotes, practically. So, you know, you have done some research on some of the things that are said here, so I don't know quite how we should go about this. But the book is called, did I say that already, The Homo and the Negro, and it's been talked about.
I always tend to get the title wrong. I always think it's The Negro and the Queer, but no, it's The Homo and the Negro.
No, and you know, James O'Meara likes that word homo. He's been using it for a long time. I don't know why he likes the word homo, but he likes to come right out and kind of shock people.
Yeah.
You know, much more than Donovan does. Donovan tries to be a little classier, but James O'Meara wants to be very culturally astute and, you know, but at the same time, kind of shock people and be, what would you call that, iconoclastic or something.
Yeah, I listened to his interview with Robert Stark, and he got a lot of... apparently his writing was heavily influenced by 70s counterculture stuff like Rolling Stone, you know, Hunter Thompson, and William S. Burroughs.
Exactly. Like exactly. Yeah. And he's had other things where he's talking about, I've got some of it down here, but, you know, he's very much into like popular culture in a way. At the same time, talks about high culture. Yeah. And he brings it all together, and this is supposed to be so brilliant of him. You know, this is supposed to be what his great brilliance is, that he brings disparate things together and makes it seem like they have some connection. Well, when I read him, I don't think that they have a connection. You know, I'm seeing that he's bringing stuff together that doesn't connect, but he's trying to connect it. And so I'm a critical reader of his, but not everybody is, and
well,
not all homosexuals.
The two main things that he's brought together are the fact, and this is pretty much an accepted fact, I think, in ethnology, that the Männerbund is a traditional and typical institution of Aryan or Indo-European societies. Even though the ethnologist that first coined that term was studying black Africans at the time.
Yeah, well, why don't you go on and explain to the listeners what you know and what you have learned about the Männerbund. And, you know, that is man or what it's man, male bonding is kind of what
well,
it means.
Well, that's the way people like to translate it. It could be a like a federation of men, sort of.
Right, a bund. That's
a society of men.
Yeah,
society of men is probably a good. I translated a little bit of the German Wikipedia entry on Männerbund. German Wikipedia is better than the English Wikipedia. So this is what German Wikipedia says. The concept of the Männerbund was created in 1902 by folklorist Henry Schurz to describe the initiation rituals in East Africa. In Wilhelmine, Germany, the term was picked up by numerous representatives of the youth movement, which would be the Wanderfugel, and filled with new content, especially by Hans Blücher.
Okay, and explain what Wanderfugel, as you pronounce it correctly, but I would say Wanderfugel, but it looks like Wandervogel. Actually, it's Vogel is birds. You know what that means and what that is in Germany. You know, it's history kind of.
Wandering birds is what it means. Wanderfugel was a kind of a youth movement. They actually had an organization. And I don't know much about them, but they wandered around. I think they wandered around the country, and a lot of them enlisted in the First World War.
Well, they didn't. I think of them as a hiking and nature loving group.
They were a lot like hippies, except they were.
Yeah, exactly.
They tended to be nationalist rather than pacifist.
Right. Yeah, they were very nationalistic, and they were kind of hippie like. We don't need these bourgeois, structure and so on. And they just dressed kind of differently, and they're out there in nature and so on. There are a lot of good things about them, and very German, and they shouldn't be seen as a bunch of homosexuals.
Adolf Eichmann had been a Wandervogel.
Well, that's a real good reference. Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, he had been, right.
So, it's continuing with German Wikipedia. Männerbund-like behavior, according to, since Georges Dumézil, has been counted as a typical characteristic of the cultures of Indo-European peoples, which means Aryan peoples. Mm-hmm. A Männerbund is a community of men bound by oath. In other words, you have to swear an oath when you join it.
Mm.
Who have a certain common goal. The collaboration in a Männerbund is defined with fixed rituals and rules. Often there is a hierarchical order. Membership in the Männerbund is often indicated by external identification indicators like symbols, certain types of clothing, hair styles, and tattoos. Women are generally excluded from the Männerbund. In addition, the Männerbund was usually socially conservative. The Männerbund typically plays an important role in the political elite and constitutes at least a portion of it. Generally, groups that call themselves Männerbünde, with reference to the way the word was used by Blücher and Schurz, appeared for relatively long periods only in Germany and Austria. In history, there have been many groups that have been designated by Schurz and his successors as Männerbünde. Most were priesthoods and warrior groups. And it gives some examples there. The Templars, some military orders, some other things. Fraternities would be examples of a Männerbund, and some other things. And it also names the Hanseatic League as an example of a Männerbund. They were organized in the form of a Männerbund. However, the question is asked, I found this very interesting. The question is asked whether these groups really are Männerbünde in the sense of Schurz's ethnological theory or homosocial groups. See, homosocial groups, they distinguish from the Männerbund.
Okay, and homosocial group, does that mean homogenous, or does that mean homosexual?
I think that probably is a kind of a bastardized use of the first half of the word homosexual with the word social stuck on the end.
Okay.
I would say that's what it means. So, in other words, German Wikipedia is distinguishing homosocial groups from the Männerbund, but that's exactly the distinction that James J. O'Meara doesn't want to make.
All righty.
Let's see. O'Meara admits that the Männerbund is not necessarily homosexual. He admitted that in his interview with Stark. In fact, historically, it has been usually not. The Männerbund is a formal association of men within a culture. If anything, this is my opinion, the relationship of homosexuality to the Männerbund is hostile, or corrosive, I should say, because the introduction of sexual perversion into a milieu where it previously did not exist reduces the ability of men to be at ease with each other. that doesn't need explanation, does it?
No.
No, I don't think so. Omira admits that, okay, that was a different note that I made. But that's what I had to say about the Männerbund.
Okay, and then he, you know, nobody makes a bigger deal out of this than him, although Donovan supports him in his comment by saying, doesn't he mention the Männerbund in his No, I don't even see it. Okay, I'll go back up to where I was. So it's Omira that talks about that an awful lot. Maybe it's even Greg Johnson who uses that word.
Well, my observation really is the Männerbund has absolutely nothing to do with homosexuality.
Yeah, let's be clear about that. And he's trying to connect it.
Yeah,
and
he's trying to say.
Because not only that, it says that in the same vein, he says that the far right cannot effectively defend Western civilization unless it checks its premises about homosexuality and non-sexual forms of male bonding. He's saying
yeah,
that
non-sexual Western, forms. Thank you.
Yeah, but of course, you know, he says that he says males need to all bond together, but there can be homosexuality and there can be non-sexual male bonds.
Yeah, the thing is, if a man has to worry about whether what another man is doing is some kind of a homosexual come on or not, that puts a big crimp in
exactly.
How friendly they can be.
Exactly. And you hear that from men all the time. That men, when men who are not homosexual and don't want to be, have to deal with that, they know that homosexuals can't resist coming on and can't resist doing this, that, or the other thing. And you have to be on guard all the time. And in the military now, you have to be on guard about homosexuals coming on to you. And it happens. You know, I was reading the other day, if a homosexual goes into a homosexual bar and stands at the bar, you know, and just looking around or gets a drink, some other homosexual male walks up to him to start talking to him. And, you know, so they get in to see if he would be open to anything. And then they said it's not at all unusual for this person who came up to talk to just grab the balls or whatever of that other man and start massaging that area. And in a homosexual bar like that, you would just, the other one would just, wouldn't be offended by it because that's the kind of place it is. But, you know, would just indicate that he doesn't want him to do that and don't do that. And the other guy will stop.
I'm not in the mood. Stop it.
Yeah, and the other guy will stop, and maybe you say, well, he's not, doesn't want anything, so he leaves and goes off looking for someone else. But now in the military, of course, you can't do that, but they're still on, you know, that's what they're thinking about. So you're exactly right, and Omira wants to ignore all that. And he says that, and then he says, following that, the rest of that sentence, the far right is undermined not just by liberals and feminists, but also by Judeo-Christian family values advocates. So he goes all the way to where anything, he hates family values. He hates families. He hates women. He hates marriage. He wants to call all of that Jewish. And, you know, if you're in the right wing, if you're a white nationalist, what's worse than what's Jewish? So he puts all that as Jewish, and then he continues on. And all these people think his writing is so great. I don't get it.
He's a good talker, you know. Yeah, as I said, he's taken some stuff. Yeah, he did take some stuff and throw it together and make something that looks like an argument, but it's not really an argument that withstands scrutiny.
Well, yeah, and then he says, you know, he brings, it's just also, he says homosexual, he argues, according to this thing about his book, he argues that homosexuals have traditionally played prominent roles in creating and conserving Western civilization. You know, that's that same old thing they come up with, Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci and whoever else they can come up with. And you're not even sure about all that, but, you know, there's some truth to it. So, you know, they want to say that, oh, you know, if it wasn't for homosexuals, there wouldn't be Western civilization. Yeah, half baloney. The stuff that we have wouldn't exist, and that is baloney.
Homosexuality takes off when a civilization is in decay.
Yeah, that's right.
And men don't have to be men anymore because the real men have established ease and safety. That's when homosexuality starts to grow.
And then he loves to talk. Of course, he's written about these people before. So this book, I think, is kind of a bunch of stuff that he's written before, and he puts it together. And this book is edited by Greg Johnson. It's not just published by Countercurrents, but it's edited by Greg Johnson. And he's also has chapters about Noel Coward, a famous homosexual, Oscar Wilde, a famous homosexual, and Humphrey Bogart. Now, why Bogart? He's trying to bring Bogart into the picture as a man's man, I think. You have an answer why?
I don't know. I wondered about that, too. I'd never heard that Humphrey Bogart was queer.
No, he's not queer. I don't think he can. He will say that. I think he'll just be calling in one of these men's men who kept women in their place, like, you know, kept Lauren Bacall lighting his cigarettes or something like that. Well, we're about out of time. So for our first hour, and look how fast it went, Hadding. So, ladies and gentlemen, we've got 30 seconds to go. We're going to come back after the musical interlude. And we'll continue with this for a while, and we're waiting for Frederick Tobin to call, if he's able to manage to do it, and if I'm able to answer his call properly. And then we will talk about his case, too, and some of these other things. So we'll just see what happens in the second hour. So I hope you stick around, and we'll be back very soon.
Dieser Tage, an dem wir bei Oma sind. Es duftet nach Kuchen und Kaffee. Wir lauschen ihren Worten, ihre Tränen sind nicht zu übersehen. Wenn sie von Oma erzählt, sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich, und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gabst dein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Erzählt von einer Zeit für uns unvorstellbar, geprägt von Tränen, Glück und Leid. Und immer wenn sie Opa sah, klingt ihre Stimme seicht und warm. Sie schließt ihre Augen und sie fällt schlafen in meinen Arm. Sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich, und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Heretics Hour. I'm Carolyn Yeager. It's I never did give the date today, but I think it's October 22nd. And my co-host tonight is Hadding Scott, and I have answered the call from Frederick Tobin. I hope. Are you on the line, Frederick? You see, he shouldn't have called in. I think during the break, he should have called in during the show, but it looks like he's here, but I don't hear him. Hi, Frederick. Or who is on the line? There's a number here. Somebody. Oh, it's still ringing. Oh, shoot. It says, shows that I answered it. Oh, he's not there now. Maybe he'll call again. I tried to answer it. It looked like I had answered it, but then he wasn't on. So I'll keep my eye on it. He's not, you know, he's not near a computer. He's traveling, so he can't send me a message or anything. Well, we'll just see. I can't have my notes and the Skype program in front of me at the same time, but I do have the SkyCon and I can see him coming in on SkyCon, so let's just continue on and see what happens. Well,
I was saying that there were two main elements in O'Meara's argument. One was the Männerbund, which he likes to portray as somehow intimately linked to homosexuality, when in reality I would say that homosexuality is destructive to it. The other element is this argument that hostility toward homosexuality is Judaic. You mentioned that. Mm-hmm. And I have an argument against that.
Good.
Well, what he's doing is he's extrapolating, because Christianity is anti-homosexual, traditionally anyway. And since Christianity has the Old Testament as one of its holy texts, and since it shares this with Judaism, since Judaism is reputed to have a stronger claim on the Old Testament, supposedly an older religion, although it really isn't, because Judaism is thought to be an older religion, O'Meara makes Judaism the root of anti-homosexual attitudes, makes Judaism responsible for what it says in the Old Testament, basically. This ignores several facts. It ignores the fact that Judaism today is not like that. Some of the most prominent homosexuals and homosexual advocates are Jews.
There you go.
And also, The fact is, if you go far enough back, hostility toward homosexuality in that tradition didn't start with the Jews. They got it from the Zoroastrians, who were Persians, which means they were Aryans.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. He also overlooks, from a racialist perspective, the fact that anti-queer or anti-homosexual attitudes prevailed in Europe before the arrival of Christianity. And the farther back you go in Europe, at least in some cases, the stronger those attitudes were. Greece and Rome were, well, Omira likes to use the example of classical Greece as an example of homosexual high culture. That's an example a lot of people like to use. Actually, some of the elite in classical Athens, 5th and 4th century, were pederasts. They liked pubescent boys, which most homosexuals today will bend over backwards to say is not their thing, because they don't want to be regarded as sexual predators.
Mm-hmm.
But for the sake of dealing with Omira on his own terms, let's say that these were homosexuals in classical Athens. Greece at that point was in its decay. They had 1,000 years of culture behind them at that point. It's when a culture is in its decay that it starts to produce literature, actually. Rome also was in its decadent phase when it started producing historical records. Now, shortly before the classical period in Greece, there had been a much less tolerant attitude toward sexual perversion, toward homosexuality. And you can find indications of this in Aristophanes' Clouds, where there's an actual argument about what we'll call homosexuals. You have the right reason and wrong reason facing off and arguing about whether it's a good or bad thing for sophists to have sex with their male students. Right reason represents the old ways. He says, this is filthy. You shouldn't be doing this. This is terrible. So it shows that this is not the way things had been until very recently. In Rome, they'd actually had a law for a couple of centuries outlawing buggery. Mm-hmm. I read this in one of Revolo Oliver's articles. I can't tell the exact name of the law, but they had a law like that. And in ancient Germany, according to Tacitus, there was a death penalty for homosexuality. They didn't like effeminate men. They would kill homosexuals by burying them in a bog because they considered it shameful. People that had committed less dishonorable crimes, they would kill in more open manners, but burying them in a bog and putting them where they can't even be seen was the way they dealt with that. Let's see. So that's what I have to say against the argument that, opposition to homosexuality is Judaic, as Omira claims.
Okay, and then, you know, I'll just throw in here, but you can continue with that if you want, that subject. But Omira, it says in this write-up that Omira draws upon masculinist writers like Hans Bleuler, Alistair Clark, and Wolf Grimson, as well as, you know, the traditionalists René Guénon, Julius Evola, and Alain Denelieu. I don't like those last three. I don't know who that third one is. But, you know, I can say I looked at pictures of Hans Bleuler, and I read some about him, too. But there was a picture, and also Alistair Clark. They do not look masculinist. You know, I wonder what Omira looks like.
I suppose this term masculinist was coined in reaction to the term feminist. I think we need some kind of reaction to feminism, but I hate to be represented by homosexuals in that dispute.
Yeah. Yeah, and we have to ask why Countercurrents has so much of these people on it, you know? I mean, the whole concept of Countercurrents comes under a big cloud, I think so. And, you know, I mean, I have been intimating that for a while, but the fact is that I keep being borne out more and more and more. I mean, this was... What they put on there today with this book is really pretty shocking, because then they go on to say that, well, this book supposedly is a work of broad learning, deep insight, and stunning originality. That's that originality again. That's that idea that he brings out ideas that nobody's ever put together before, and it's supposed to be stunning originality, where there's just
saying
speech.
What the queers want to hear, so, you know.
Yeah, yeah, just like all the pictures they put on there. So many of them are pictures that queers like to look at, you know, men with hardly any clothes on, or, you know, and manly-looking statues and so on, and if they have women, they're always ugly. So they have this really ugly woman on there now, who's supposed to be, I forgot already, but I was looking at the video they have, and she's just horrible. She's just a horrible creep, you know? I mean, awful looking and sounds terrible. So that's what they like to put on there. Then we have Greg Johnson saying, that James O'Meara's work centers on the politics of sexuality. So what is that? The sexual orientation, Hanning? Is that what that's supposed to be about?
Queer advocacy. Explaining to white nationalists why they should be pro-queer, basically.
Okay. And then Jack Donovan says that reading James O'Meara is a psychedelic experience. That's the same thing as the stunning originality, I guess. And he plucks unexpected ideas from far corners and combines them in novel arguments that will blow your mind. And he says that among the good points that O'Meara makes is that the right is suffocating from a stuffy bourgeois blandness incapable of igniting the imagination. You think so? Is that the problem?
Say that again.
The right is, he says, O'Meara makes some good points. The right is suffocating from a stuffy bourgeois blandness incapable of igniting the imagination.
Well, I think there's a lot of bourgeois thinking in the proper sense of the term. We have a lot of our people that pose as racial radicals are really just Reaganites that, are ready to be more honest than most.
But there's nothing wrong with a little bourgeois. I don't think there's anything wrong with a little bourgeois. Otherwise, are we communists or Marxists or something that we have to paint the bourgeois as totally evil to be, you know, destroyed or something?
Because Gottfried Feder has some very nasty things to say about the bourgeoisie in his manifesto.
Well, I guess it depends on how you're looking at it, but, you know, it can just be the... There's a certain...
See, are the members of the I've Got Mine Club.
The what?
The I've Got Mine Club.
I've Got Mine Club. Yeah.
These are the people that think it's fine to vote for...
Romney. I'm going to vote for Romney. I am going to go out and vote. I'm going to vote for Romney. Because there's worse things than what he stands for. There's worse things at this moment in time. Now, so Jack Donovan continues after that sentence about the suffocation and so on. It's creepy, the bourgeois blandness. It's creepy, puritanical obsession with exiling the homo.
Right there. It's not puritanical. It's a very ancient aversion to homosexuality. It's ancient. It doesn't come from Christianity and doesn't come specifically from Puritanism either.
Mm-hmm. Well,
what's creepy now? Most people would think buggery is creepy.
Well, yeah. Yeah, but they don't want to talk
about
that.
That's pretty obvious inversion right there.
Yeah, they never will talk about buggery, will they? They'll only talk about this manliness and manhood and male bonding and so on. They
all
never
about
talk
puffing
about
up
what
your chest
really
and posing for photographs.
You know, if you go to those sites of for male sex toys, homosexual, there's lesbian ones too. But you look at this underwear they have.
I don't want to look at it. I don't want to see anything like that. I don't
want
to hear about it.
That these guys are supposed to be going around all day wearing this for underwear. You know what's on their mind. They're ready for anything. You know, they're ready. So it's just, it's, oh, so anyway, he goes on that's not all the sentence. He says, this obsession with exiling the homo has driven off a disproportionate number of men whose natural talents would make them best able to translate virility into transcendent high culture. See, these guys are dreaming.
I think if these guys really are talented, they can be talented while keeping their perversion in the closet also.
Of course, it's not a perversion to them. It said, we'll need dynamic groups of men. Here's his final, just Jack Donovan, he's pretty good. We'll need dynamic groups of men who aren't so worried about being called queers that they rely on female chaperones.
Oh, my God, we need whole groups of queers.
To authenticate their manhood. See how much they hate those women getting in there. They, you know, women coming along with a man is just a female chaperone to authenticate that they're a man. And what they need are men who are not afraid to come right out and be called queers. And that's what Countercurrents is doing. I think, you know, that's what Countercurrents is helping them do. And that's what Countercurrents seems to be for. You know, for all their thing about culture and all the good aesthetics on that site and supposedly good writing, there's some of it. You know, this seems to be taking over. And I, you know, they have this big push for money. And I think that a lot of money comes from homosexuals who, there's a lot of very successful ones, especially in the arts and, you know, media and Hollywood and all that stuff. And they'd be supporting this. So they'd probably get a lot of money. So I think they've decided. I think, my conjecture is that, the owners of that site have decided. We always forget to mention Michael Polignano, who's a big part of it. They have decided that they can't cover up the homosexuality anymore. And, if somebody like me or White Network is going to be talking about it, they'll just tolerate that and just hope that they can, you know, convince enough people and, because, they need the money. And I think they want money. They want to live well and they want to bring in plenty of money.
Yeah.
And, they've got, you know, they're closing in on their $25,000 for the year. Can you imagine? I can't imagine what I'd do with that, but I think they live on it, so that's it. But, you know, then I'm just saying that good people in the white nationalist movement shouldn't be going there and shouldn't be pulled into that. That's my opinion. I've said it before, and I don't.
Well, the whole thing, it's it's a big embarrassment. It's a big embarrassment to have a major white nationalist site dominated by advocacy for sexual perversion.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell is this? My God, the FBI used to start rumors like that in order to destroy organizations. And now we've got these guys doing it to themselves overtly.
Well, how do you think that this, you know, I think all this started, I think this is just a further evolvement of the sexual revolution that came about in the 60s. Now, that's what Professor Kevin MacDonald says, and he talks about it quite a bit. I listened to a program he was on that other white network, that White Voice program, just last night because somebody had told me about it. And he is, again, talking about the sexual revolution in the 1960s. It started all this. And we have just gone more and more into freedom to where we've ended up with this. Do you think?
Well, it's the next stage in the so-called civil rights movement. The blacks don't want any association with
with queer liberation, but
okay. Here's this call. Let me go ahead and talk while I'm trying to do this right.
Well, queer liberation is portrayed as the last. I guess it's the last stage. It's the next stage, anyway. In the
I think I did it wrong.
The post-war
there
liberation. After the blacks get their rights, then the queers get theirs.
Hello.
But blacks don't like to
Hello
be
Hello there. Yeah, we've got him. Good hey. For you, Frederick. You called.
Caroline. Yes. Good afternoon, or is it good evening to you, isn't it?
Yes, we're here. It's dark. It's in the evening, but it's afternoon for you. Listeners, this is Frederick Tobin. He's calling from Australia on our new telephone line. And Hadding Scott is here, too, Frederick.
Hello.
Well, it's interesting what you've been doing.
Well, thank you.
I think you're the only one at the moment who dares touch the topic realistically, without any malice, without any pretense at all sorts of things that the others are pushing.
Well, thank you. You know, I have never really intended to do it, but I look back and I say, well, I started with my very second program on the White Network after I moved, got my own, you know, network where I didn't feel constrained, and it just has opened up, and a lot of things have opened up since then. So I can't really stop it, even though I thought I was done with it, but there's more and more and more. So now this thing in Britain, you know, are you familiar with that Jimmy Savile scandal that's going on? Well, we won't take any time with that. You know, Hadding and I were just finishing up with this topic, and so you called just at the right time because I was just going to say, well, let's talk about Frederick Tobin's case now. And before we run out of time and get into that, and now here you are, so we can continue talking about it after you get off the line, whenever it is that you need to hang up. But if you can stay on, that's fine too. But so why don't you describe to us what has happened with you? And I'm sure a lot of our listeners do know some about it, but they're very happy to hear directly from you. What has been happening to you in your own words?
Well, firstly, I'm sitting in a car. I'm 100 kilometers from Adelaide, and I'm almost in the middle of nowhere, which indicates that we're still in communication, that it's possible in today's situation to make contact with the other side of the world or to stay in contact. I'm not in email contact or in internet. I haven't got an internet contact. It's just a mobile phone.
Right.
And that's fine. And I did send you, though, per email, the various items that are impacting on my situation. Namely,
yeah, I have it all right here. I have it all in front of me. But it's good to hear it from you.
Yeah, like after 18 years of trying to find out what this Holocaust thing is all about, I have come to the end of the line. And the person who pursued me since then, or the persons, they have succeeded in bankrupting me, meaning that financially I'll be supervised for 3 years now, and I have the only income I do have is my age pension, but nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
And so this means that the court costs that I paid last year, where I had then had to sell my house.
How much did you pay? What did you pay in court costs last year?
All up, they wanted 56, I think it was 56,000. All up, though, to sell and so on, was about 75,000. And I thought that would clear it, but it didn't, because they came up with the new court costs, which was 175,000, and that's just too much. But I must say,
that just sounds crooked, Frederick.
Of course
that
it does, but there are two ways. Yeah, but there are 200. There are two ways of killing a person. One is shooting them outright, and the other is by taking them through the law courts. But the what I wanted to say was that in November 2010, 2 years ago, 2007, I must go back, 2007, in November, they offered a settlement which consisted of my apologizing for having upset the Jewish community and having made these outrageous statements.
Right.
So I signed this, and then I had a barrister pro bono working for this, and he, on the 7 o'clock at night, he sent it to me per email. I read it through the next morning in court. I signed it and read it out, gave this apology, and then I started deleting material, and then I realized that what we had not discussed, they wanted me to delete links from the website to other websites, and that was not part of the apology. Then the big deciding point came when somebody in Sydney sent me a copy of the front page of the Australian Jewish News, where it said, Tobin gives Holocaust denial apology. And of course, my apology wasn't that. Mine was like Bishop Williamson. He apologized to the Pope for upsetting him. And I also apologized. I also apologized to the federal court for upsetting them with my matter. But I did not recant. And this is where then on the Friday, because after I'd signed this and made the statement, I felt sick. And a couple of other mates with me in court, they felt sick. They were almost abusive towards me, saying that I'd let everyone down and so on. And then I was really physically sick, and then but I submitted to this nonsense and started deleting. And then when I then decided that I'd been conned, then I stopped deleting and publicly stated I was withdrawing my apology on that account. And I felt much better. And then, of course, that 2007, 2008, the hearing was on. In 2009, I was imprisoned because I was found to be in contempt, contumacious, something contempt of court. In other words, I was a really naughty boy.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Is it two Jewish organizations that have been after you, or just one? Or is it two men from the same organization?
The Jewish groups in Australia, they have so many organizations, they're only one-man outfit, or two or three. It all sounds good, but they were just as unincorporated, an unincorporated body, the Executive Council of Australian Jewry, as is Adelaide Institute. That's unincorporated. And therefore, essentially, forget the labels of the organization that pursues you, for example, like the Southern Poverty Law Center, mm-hmm. or the others, what's the one in Canada, Warman in Canada. They all have good names, but ultimately it's individuals pushing it. That's the important thing to remember.
Right. Okay.
And I seem to be upsetting certain individuals when I say, don't blame the Jews, blame those that bend to their pressure. And I can now say, and I did say in court, that Jones and Lewis, Stephen Lewis, that they want their pound of flesh. Going back to Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice, it's all there. But Shakespeare also said, never a borrower or lender be, because it blunts the edge of husbandry. In other words, you've got to work. Unfortunately, our debtor society, we sometimes do have to borrow money and so on. But the important thing is, when I say don't blame the Jews, blame those that bend to their pressure, the important thing to remember is if you accept that as a premise, then you go back one further and say, wait a minute, if you can't blame the Jews, what happens? And in my case, I had two individuals, Catherine McAvoy, she's a law lecturer at Adelaide University. She became a commissioner for the Human Rights Commission and Equal Opportunity Commission. She found me, she found that I'd have been offended the Jewish groups. Then, but because the Human Rights Commission didn't have the legal power to punish, it was taken to the Federal Court of Australia, and there Justice Catherine Branson made a finding, and because I didn't find a barrister to help me in this stage of matters of fact, she simply made a summary judgment and found me guilty. And in that article that's gone through, reporting on the bankruptcy, it says that I have said those people who believe in the Holocaust are of limited intelligence. I have never said that. This is part of the Branson orders, that number three, I think it is. One is that I'm not allowed to doubt the Holocaust. Two, that I'm not allowed to state that there were no gas chambers at Auschwitz. And number four is I'm not allowed to say that there is a Holocaust industry. Now, this means that these two women, they set the groundwork. Non-Jews, they set the groundwork, and then another non-Jew, Justice Lander, found, of course, according to the Act, the material is likely to offend. It only happened to be likely to offend. Well, of course, anything can offend. And therefore, he had to find, and we confirmed what Branson had put there. But that's where I say, I walked out of the Human Rights Commission hearings because I asked the commissioner, is truth a defense in these proceedings? In 1996, 1997, I said, can I defend myself if I say something that's rude and crude and so on? I'll apologize. But I will not apologize if I state something that's a physical fact, because, and I did say that, I have been to Auschwitz, and I saw the four holes weren't there. There is no gas chamber there. And therefore, let's have a commission. Let's look at this, and not let's punish these people who say, or who refuse to. Can you hear the traffic?
Yes, I can. Every so often.
Zooming past. Yes, so that's essentially it. That when
so,
I say,
so these two women, one is one was a judge, one was the
one
judge
was,
in the court.
Yes.
And the other one is what?
Yes, she was a law. She's still a law lecturer, and of course, in 2006, I enrolled in law at the Adelaide University, and I failed her subject by 4 marks.
Oh.
And of course, you know, this is, I mean, this is just nonsense. But the problem is, in one other subject, I got a credit. But it doesn't matter. That's another story.
But these women, who have, you know, kind of worked against you, they're not Jewish. Is that right?
No, this is what I'm saying. This is why I'm saying.
Yeah.
Because in this way, we move one step further than the scapegoating that occurs so often, where people say, yes, it's the Jews, it's the Jews. Well, I can say now in my case, of course it's the Jews. It's Jeremy Jones and Stephen Lewis, among others, Robert Good, Stephen Rothman, he's now a judge. He used to, in 98, he said, oh, Frederick Tobin is a very sick man. See, but now he's a judge, well, he's protected. But they were allowed to say all sorts of things. They were allowed to say it's Holocaust denial instead of Holocaust revisionism. They're allowed to say it's anti-Semitism, when in fact it's got nothing to do with so-called anti-Semitism. I'm not against the Arabs or any Semitic-speaking people. Mm-hmm. So this is where we are at a disadvantage. We just haven't got the power, but if a minority controls majority, then I don't blame the minority, because it's in their nature wanting to control like everybody else. And therefore, it's the majority that's got to wake up. And that's what you're doing, Caroline.
Well,
you are waking up. But some of your critics, of course, they'll not get involved in what you're talking about. They'll rather say you're a hysterical woman.
Yes.
Well,
right.
So am I. I've been called so many things. It just doesn't matter. Name calling. You know, what is it? Sticks and stones.
Yeah. Can break my bones, break my but bones. Names can never hurt me. Well, we said that from the time I was a little kid. But, you know, Frederick, what we'd like to know.
That's maturation.
Yeah, maturity.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we would like to know how bad your situation is. I mean, you said that you are you countersuing for defamation against yourself by these Jewish gentlemen?
Well, that still has to be decided. We've waited 2 months on a decision whether this action has got legs or not, whether it's going to run or not. So at the moment, I just don't know. As a bankrupt, you usually cannot, any court action ceases. But if it's personal damage, that can then go. But
well,
as
now,
I
as
said,
a bankrupt,
all,
as a bankrupt, you've already lost your house. You have some kind of a place out somewhere that you were building, working on. Yeah. But you said for 3 years you can't leave the country. They've got your passport. You can't go anywhere. Well, they think that's real funny because you can't go to any Holocaust denial meetings anywhere.
No, the other thing is I've lived in a home in Adelaide for almost 20 years, and this is my backstop. This is where I've been. So from that comfort point of view, I've still got that. It's not my home. It can't be taken away.
Oh, they didn't. Didn't take that home of yours. You didn't lose your home.
No.
Oh, I thought you did.
No. But I had my home. I did have a home in the bush. That's gone.
Oh.
That had to be sold last year for the first bite at this the repayment.
You can't pay this thing, now they're calling you bankrupt. Now if you can't pay this, is there some period of time and then it's all washed away or what?
Yeah, it's 3 years. 3 years.
3 years. Okay.
So I've got to be a good boy.
3 years.
I've got to be a good boy for 3 years.
That's what's so terrible. You know, you can't. Can you go on the internet? What are the restrictions put on you besides losing?
I'll be finding that out in a week or two. The limitations.
Well, they give you more time.
So, if anyone is listening, anyone who really, I mean, it's a marvelous that we've got these young people, Zion Crime Factory, Eric's doing his job. It is wonderful to see these things coming through because this younger generation doesn't want to be hoodwinked. It wants to know the truth because, I mean, it's a hackneyed phrase, but truth does liberate you. It does set you free. But ultimately, if we talk about freedom, we need that freedom. It's only in our mind. And that's the beauty, that if you've got that home within your mind, then what they do physically to you doesn't really matter, as long as you've got that home within your mind. And to be living a lie, I mean, that's terrible.
Well, can you write?
I would.
Can you write books? Can you write articles and can you post things on the internet, or do you said you don't know that yet. That's right.
I don't know yet, no.
Yeah. Is there a way for people to send you money at the Adelaide Institute website or anything like that?
Well, I don't know. I'm not. This is the other point. The newspaper article indicated I was still in charge of Adelaide Institute. I'm not. Since 2009, Peter Hartung took over.
That's right. I know. He's
now in charge.
Yeah.
All these newspaper articles are never correct.
You're right. You're absolutely right. They're not.
Because they don't do the right thing. They don't they don't come to me or they don't ring me up and say, what's your point of view?
They lie. They keep repeating the same lies and they don't care. You know, don't care.
Oh, yes.
Accurate.
Yeah.
At all.
But anyway, Caroline, I must sign off. And I would just like to say again, keep going. What you're doing, you're pioneering it. And isn't it horrible? You're a woman.
Yeah.
Because we've had a bit of trouble with with the sexist business in Australian politics, where these so-called left-wing people, they're pulling out the sexist card, they're pulling out the racist card, and all these just to block inquiry. And most revisionists know that they've been, well, what effect this has when somebody says, you're not allowed to say this, worse still, you're not allowed to think about it. This is why it's so important to have that freedom, which the American Constitution, with its First Amendment, still celebrates. But they're working hard at knocking it out.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's really...
And very often...
Go ahead.
Yeah, and very often, it's done by non-Jews. So, this scapegoating, we must stop scapegoating. If scapegoating is clear-cut, then yes, like I can say, they got me. But I must then also add, but it was the helpers, the non-Jews, who actually set the stage. And the client media.
Yes.
Okay,
well, thank you very much, Frederick. And, of course, we're going to continue talking about this after you hang up and talking about your situation for the rest of the program. So thanks a lot for checking in. You did a great job.
All right. Thank you very much. Right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Now, we're going to see what happens when he hangs up. Okay. I'm not going to worry about it. I think he's gone. All right.
Right.
I'm hearing my voice coming back.
You know what he said about the traitors, the white traitors? That's your bourgeoisie right there.
Well, but just because a person... I'm hearing myself. How come? Maybe it's something to do with...
Too loud. Maybe you try to turn it down.
Yeah. I'll talk softer, too. Being a respectable middle class or something does not make people necessarily behave that way. You know, that in itself is not... Look at all the people that aren't bourgeois. What do? They do things, too. I don't know. Well, I'm not going to spend any time defending the bourgeois because I can't even exactly say who they are. But, that's one of Frederick's things that... I haven't always liked hearing it, but he's been saying it for a long time, and he can point to cases where it's absolutely true that, and he says that the Jews are going to do what they do. He was a little bit nicer about it on the phone here, but you know, the Jews do what Jews do, and you can't blame Jews for being Jews and doing what Jews do. So that's kind of his thing. But yeah, it's the non-Jews who are helping them or doing these things, we can blame them.
Well, that's true. I mean, yeah, the Jews used to be able to not do very much damage when we had a cohesive culture. It was during the age of exploration when certain segments of society had newfound wealth and they were interested in getting rich, and that's your bourgeoisie again. Then a lot of fissure lines, a lot of cracks opened up in the social fabric, and Jews were able to take advantage of that. Also, you can read Brooks Adams to get a theory of how a society becomes more vulnerable to Jewish exploitation as a result of centralization, largely. Unless a society takes deliberate measures to prevent wealth from becoming the dominant factor in itself. That's what will happen, and that produces, it leads to the destruction of a society eventually.
Yes, and now here's Frederick Tobin. He said 18 years he's been doing this, and he's a man of real moral fiber. He's a man of integrity. That's what I'm... He has a lot of integrity. He has a real philosophical approach to life. He's a wonderful guy. You know, I met him in person and spent a couple of days in his company. Was it 2010 or 2009? And talked a lot with him in conjunction with other people and a lot with just me and another person. And well, we were talking together for a while at breakfast in the morning, in this motel, a hotel we were all staying in. Some of us were. And, you know, you can just, we just talk. What do you call that, when you, you know, try to get everything somebody knows, you know? I just asked him question after question after question. He's so agreeable and he just answered everything. And he told me all about different people and all the things that experiences with them. A lot of it was kind of in a sense, you know, gossipy, but it was great because I didn't know any of this stuff. And so it wasn't really gossip, but you know, that in nature, personal stuff. And, he doesn't hold much back. So you have to be careful what you tell him because he might be telling other people, but he travels around. He's got a great attitude, very positive. And they, you know, look, they've succeeded in just, you know, bringing him to this pass. You know, these guys, these Jews, they never quit. And they're so gleeful now that he doesn't have his passport and that he's bankrupt, that he has to stay, where he is and he can't do this, he can't do that, you know. And, I just think that the battle, that surrounds the Holocaust and, is, of the Jews. And there's another kind of a loss we've had recently. I can't, I'll think of it, but it's, I don't know if we're winning or not. You know, I think that we're losing in the establishment, where you have things going on in courts and they're passing laws in all these countries and keep passing more laws and they keep having more of these, days of remembrance and all this stuff to just keep pushing it in and stuff in the schools. And so on. I think they're really gaining there. But as far as people, the people believing in any of it, I think they're losing there. But I don't know if that matters as much.
Well, I think when they prosecute, or in this case, I guess it was a civil suit, when they drag into court a Holocaust denier like that, it draws attention to the whole issue. It's not really a win for them to do that.
Yeah, that's what I was saying to Gunter Deckert a couple of weeks ago, that like with this Gerhard Ittner, and in Germany generally, when these people are taken to court, when they arrest people and so on, they do not put it in the mainstream media, unless you're Williamson. Even him, they don't want to write about too much. Because they don't want the German people to realize how much they're going after these people. And they keep it quiet. But the Jews will always talk about it. It's always in the Jewish media. Because they like to brag about it. But I agree. Frederick Tobin is getting a lot of sympathy. And that's why we want to get his story out there. So that he does get the sympathy. So people realize how nasty these people are, and they want to destroy the lives of those who they think. But of course, as Frederick would say, they see them as, you know, terrible people, Holocaust deniers. And these are 6 million Jewish souls were murdered, and they want to deny this. And so these people are the worst of the worst.
There'll be some free thinkers out there. There'll be some people who say, well, I can't understand. I would like to know why this man is a Holocaust denier. I would like to hear his explanation. I would like to be able to understand the motives of somebody that would say this. I mean, that's where I was about 30 years ago.
Well, yes, exactly. Everybody was there at some point in time. But, you know, in Australia, where he lives, he doesn't have much sympathy. I mean, nobody seems to care about him in Australia. He's more popular around the world than he is in Australia. There's not much, talk about the bourgeois, I guess. The people in Australia are not too interested in this kind of stuff, and they're quite, I don't know. There's groups, you know, I know a lot of Australians that are fighting it all, but I think that they have a hard time, and the Australian government is very, pro-Jewish and pro-Holocaust, you know, and let's get some more stuff you know, let's send some more kids to the camp, museums, and so on.
Is it Tobin descended from German Templars that were sent to Australia from Palestine?
He's descended from Germans who went to Australia as farmers and farmed there. I don't think he goes way back in Australia. I think his parents went there. He was born there, though. Parents are his grown. And, you know, he has a twin brother that you never hear about. But he has one.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he's a twin. He thinks that he knows quite a bit about twins. And he says, he has said at times, well, this is explained because I'm a twin. He says, well, you have to know that I'm a twin to understand this about me. But I have not ever been able to really put that together. Well, we've got 10 minutes, Hadding, and
well, do you want to hear what's wrong with Greggy's gang's use of Julius Evola?
Oh, sure. Okay.
I had a friend of mine that knows about Evola give me a rundown on Evola's attitude toward homosexuality. Okay, here's what he wrote. A key theme in Evola's Metaphysics of Sex is Plato's myth of the androgyne, not as a glorification of androgyny, but as an explaining myth relating to the natural polarity of male and female seeking reunification through sex and marriage. From there, it is not hard to extrapolate how Evola would regard homosexuality as an aberration, even though he validates some forms of socially questionable deviance, such as sadomasochism, for the enhanced employment of physical excitation subordinate to spiritual purposes. This does not appear to extend to homosexuality in Evola's thought. He is working more from the tantric line of thought, the formula of turning the objects of bondage desire into vehicles of liberation. Let's see. I don't see homosexuality as anything that could be translated into these terms. And then he says, he agreed with Goethe that homosexuality, being present from time immemorial, is probably a part of nature while still being against nature.
Okay, here's the thing where I did some research that I've actually published on my website says that there's only 1-3% of the population are homosexual. 1-3%, and that seems to stay pretty stable. Now, how do you explain all these homosexuals popping up everywhere?
They're making a lot of noise.
They're making a lot of noise, or people are becoming homosexual who wouldn't otherwise, because it's once it becomes popular in the culture, and they're rewarded.
Theory that I read from a psychiatrist in the Third Reich was that there was a small number of men that were homosexual by birth and a large number that were recruited into it.
Well, that's right. That was the National Socialist thing. That was their theory. That's what they came up with in their research. And that's what these researchers now to say also. So, but you know, you'd think, from these people that we're talking about here, countercurrents and so on, that it's very normal and that they might push that 10% thing, which is supposed to be false, but there's maybe it appears that there's 10% who say they are, but I don't know how that works actually, where that 10% comes from.
I don't think
10%
of the population is a homosexual.
Well,
10% of the population might be open to trying something weird on occasion, but I don't think 10% is primarily homosexual.
That might be it. It might be that 10% has been found here or there or doing something or other or whatever. So this androgyny thing. So were you saying that Evola's goes along with this idea that marriage, or males and females are seeking to unite in order to
The reference is to the speech that Aristophanes gives in Plato's Symposium, where he talks about how originally males and females were united as one. And that the unity of male and female was so happy. And then
they got divided.
So it's an idealization of androgyny, that the androgynous person is the ideal or something?
No. It's the idea of polarity. You have male and female seeking unity.
Okay. All right.
That's Evola's concept, according to my friend's summary. It says he agreed with Goethe that homosexual being present from time, and because that's the concept, that because that's Evola's concept of sex, homosexuality doesn't fit into it. He agreed with Goethe that homosexuality being present from time immemorial is probably a part of nature while still being against nature. He interprets Plato's Aphrodite Urania versus Aphrodite Pandemos regarding the earlier concept of noble love or appreciation of members of the same sex, even youth, in contrast with later obviously carnal pederasty present in other Greek later Greek writers. He explicitly regards physical homosexuality between men or women as a deviation from whatever original idea was, whenever the original idea was, and he explicitly calls it degenerate. He closes the section on homosexuality, essentially stating that it is both perverse and degenerate and indefensible, even on the same grounds that he later defends heterosexual deviancy, in at least potentially still being subordinate to the principles of polarity. So the main thing for Evola with sex is polarity, the male-female polarity.
Yeah, well, and then nature tells us that. And the whole idea of polarities, everything is a polarity. So it's ridiculous.
These people calling themselves New Right and talking about Evola. And they talk about René Guénon, too. René Guénon became a Muslim. Mm-hmm. Where does homosexuality fit into that?
And he married a Muslim woman after he became Muslim. But that doesn't mean much of anything. Well, you know what? What is going on? I wish this guy would quit sending me Skype messages when I'm on a program. What is going on during the... What kind of attitude should we have with what's going on with counter currents? Hattie,
don't read it.
Well, there's too much interesting stuff that comes up there for me not to read it.
A lot of it is old stuff. Like they just posted some plagiarized article from Ted O'Keefe from 30 years ago. You know, a friend of mine says that that's what used to get him to donate, but he stopped donating when he realized that most of the good stuff on there was old.
Well, yeah, you've said that before. Yeah. Okay, well, people will say I'm making too much out of this, and people will say, well, let people do whatever they want. but then when people talk about white nationalism, you know, this guy's won't quit doing that. When people talk about white nationalism, I would say we've got so many various forms of it, and there's no leadership that really works because people tolerate what others are doing, no matter what it is, even though it goes in a totally wrong direction.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.